Welcome to IADEM Research Active Recovery Series. We are launching a deep dive today into the emerging edges of athletic recovery.
We're talking about the high-tech gadgets, the precise nutritional strategies, and this really confusing landscape where multi-billion dollar marketing meets hard physiological reality.
And our mission here is, well, it's specifically for you, the informed athlete.
Exactly. Maybe you're balancing a full life with intense training. Maybe you're getting into that master's category, and your time and your money are, frankly, precious.
So we want to equip you with the knowledge to get the maximum return on investment, or ROI, from every single recovery effort you make.
We have a pretty comprehensive stack of sources here, everything from FDA regulatory documents, industry funding disclosures, all the way to, meticulous systematic reviews on everything from pneumatic boots to the humble tart cherry.
And we're going to use all of it to try and separate the scientific signal from what is often just commercial noise.
And we have to start with the central, uncomfortable truth that really defines this whole field. It's a core paradox that if you don't grasp it, you could spend thousands of dollars trying to actively sabotage your own training.
That truth is this. Many interventions that dramatically improve those acute short-term biomarkers.
Right. So they make you feel better. They drop measurable levels of cellular damage, something like creatine kinase or CK.
But they often fail to enhance actual functional performance, your sprint speed, your vertical jump, your endurance in the next session.
And here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, pretty counterintuitive. Some of these exact same interventions.
The ones that promise instant relief.
Yes, the ones that make you feel recovered quickly. They may actively impair the long-term training adaptations that were the entire point of your hard session in the first place.
So you're saying I might be paying a premium to undo my own hard-earned gains?
You might quite literally be doing just that.
And to understand why this is so important, we have to look at the scale of this market. This isn't some niche corner of the fitness world.
Not at all. The athletic recovery technology market was valued at $3.1 billion in 2024.
And it's projected to skyrocket to $10.5 billion by 2033.
And that kind of financial explosion, well, it means the incentive to sell a product often far outstrips the incentive to produce objective, gold standard scientific proof.
So when you see that level of commercial growth, the informed athlete has to just automatically adopt a stance of critical scrutiny.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack the financial structure that makes this market so opaque. The confusion, it seems to flow from two main channels.
That's right. First, who is footing the bill for the research? And second, how easy it is to introduce a new high-tech device without any kind of rigorous regulatory review.
Let's start with industry funding. It's huge in the supplement world, and you're saying it's creeping into the device space now, too.
Oh, it's rampant. Our sources indicate that an estimated 50 to 70% of all dietary supplement research is funded by the very industries that profit from those sales.
That statistic alone should set off alarm bells. But, let's move beyond just intuition. What does the objective data say about this bias?
A comprehensive Cochrane review, which is really the gold standard for this kind of analysis, found a measurable tilt toward positive outcomes.
A tilt how?
Specifically, they found that industry-sponsored studies are 27% more likely to report favorable efficacy results. To use the statistical term, they reported a relative risk of 1.27.
Okay.
And what's more, they were 34% more likely to report favorable conclusions compared to independently funded research.
So the science isn't necessarily fabricated, but the selection, the interpretation, the publication of the results, it's all demonstrably less objective when the sponsor has a financial stake in the outcome.
It's basically institutionalized confirmation bias. And as you said, this isn't just about powders and pills anymore.
Right.
Device funding is following the exact same pattern. For example, Therabody announced a massive $10 million research pledge in March of 2024.
Okay, wait a minute. $10 million sounds like they're serious about the science. Isn't that scale of investment actually better for the quality of the research?
It's a great question, but it's still a potential red flag.
Why?
It's a red flag because when the research validation becomes integrated into the marketing arm of a company, the ultimate goal shifts. It's less about discovering truth and more about confirming a product's utility.
So they're asking questions designed to highlight a benefit, however minor, rather than testing a hypothesis rigorously against, say, a low-cost alternative.
Precisely. The critical thinking burden gets placed squarely on your shoulders, the athlete.
And then beyond the funding problem, we run into this massive regulatory loophole here in the United States.
That loophole is the FDA's 2019 General Wellness Policy for Low-Risk Devices. Let me define that clearly. This policy essentially exempts devices from active mandatory regulation.
Meaning they don't have to prove they work.
Exactly. As long as their claims relate only to general health.
And what exactly does general health mean in this context?
It means claims like promotes relaxation, improves circulation, or relieves general aches and pains. They aren't regulated if they're not claiming to treat or cure a specific disease, like diabetes or cancer.
So what this means for you, the informed consumer, is that if a company isn't claiming to cure a diagnosed medical condition, they're selling you something that has the same regulatory oversight as a fancy gym bag, even if it costs five figures.
Buyer beware is absolutely the law of the land here, and we have a perfect massive case study of this, whole body cryotherapy, or WBC.
Right. The market for cryo is huge. It was valued at nearly $3 billion in 2024, projected to hit over $4 billion by 2030, but there's a fundamental regulatory reality here.
The reality is that WBC chambers are not FDA cleared or approved for any medical indication.
None.
The FDA has issued explicit warnings, citing risks like asphyxiation and frostbite, and they've cautioned the public about unproven claims for serious conditions like Alzheimer's, anxiety, or migraines.
So the entire commercial success of this industry thrives in this non-regulated gray area.
Completely.
Yeah.
Now let's look at a similar high-end technology, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, or HBOT, which does have clearer regulation.
Okay, so how does that change the economic picture?
Well, HBOT chambers are Class II medical devices. That means they pose a moderate risk and require specific controls. The FDA has cleared them, but only for 14 specific medical conditions.
Things like severe burns, carbon monoxide poisoning.
Exactly. Or certain diabetic foot ulcers.
Hmm.
But explicitly not for athletic recovery or performance enhancement. The FDA has even issued warning letters to manufacturers who make those unproven claims.
This brings us right back to the ROI question. If I'm an athlete considering this, knowing the FDA hasn't approved it for my use, what does the financial cost benefit look like?
It is a steep investment. Clinical HBOT at a facility, if you're going three times a week, can cost roughly £12,480 a year.
Wow.
But we did identify an interesting economic angle. An individual can actually buy a personal soft HBOT chamber for around £12,000.
So if I use it frequently, say three times a week, I achieve an economic break-even point in about 1 year.
That's correct. Ownership becomes economically rational if you use it frequently. And if you decide the outcomes from a mild chamber are good enough for your goals.
But the critical constraint is insurance, right?
Almost universally denied for athletic recovery. This is a cash pay service driven entirely by the athlete's disposable income and their belief in the product.
And that's where we get into the core conflict.
Hmm.
The difference between feeling recovered and actually being functionally ready for your next hard effort.
This is really the intellectual heart of our deep dive today.
Okay.
The disconnect is this. Most interventions, especially the high-tech ones, they focus on these acute biomarkers. Creatine kinase or CK, lactate dehydrogenase, LDH, or just subjective soreness.
But they fail to show improvements in the things that actually matter. Speed, power, endurance.
Exactly.
So let's define those biomarkers for a second. When we talk about creatine kinase, what are we actually measuring?
CK is an enzyme that leaks out of damaged muscle cells. So high CK levels are, you know, essentially a proxy for muscle damage.
So when a device says it reduces CK quickly, what's happening?
It just means less of the cell contents are spilling out, or maybe the cleanup crew is working a bit faster. It might reduce the signal of damage, but that doesn't necessarily mean the muscle is structurally sound enough to perform better.
Performance is the true metric.
Let's look at a tool often used in high-performance environments. Neuromuscular electrical stimulation, or NMES.
Right, often sold under various recovery brands.
NMES generally shows pretty mixed results for performance enhancement. A 2014 systematic review by Malone and colleagues, it covered 13 different studies.
Then what did it find?
It concluded that the evidence did not convincingly support NMES over active or passive recovery for enhancing subsequent performance.
That's the crucial baseline finding right there. It doesn't beat resting or just walking around. And yet there was a 2022 study that really highlighted this difference between perception and performance.
That study is a perfect illustration of the psychological power of these devices. It found a quasi-significant trend for greater perceived recovery with NMES versus just rest.
So the athlete felt better.
They felt better, more recovered, psychologically ready. But The study also stated there were no benefits for any remaining outcomes,
which included objective metrics like
jump performance, blood lactate clearance, muscle oxygen kinetics, nothing.
So if I'm paying hundreds for a device that makes me feel better but doesn't make me faster or stronger for my next workout, am I wasting my money, or is that perception of recovery valuable?
The feeling is valuable, for sure, but it's not performance. You've paid for perception, not a physiological advantage.
Right.
Now, it's important to say, NMES has a much clearer evidence-based role in clinical settings where adaptation isn't the primary goal.
Like injury recovery?
Exactly. A very recent 2025 meta-analysis showed that NMES combined with exercise therapy significantly reduced pain and increased quad strength in patients with patellofemoral pain. So the tool is useful, but we have to be precise about its application.
Okay, let's move on to another one you see everywhere. Pneumatic compression devices, or PCDs. Normatec, jet boots. They're standard issue in pro locker rooms.
And they've become a huge status symbol for serious athletes. They work by applying sequential pressure, aiming to promote venous return, reduce swelling.
And they show some modest benefits for blood flow, right? Hemodynamics?
They do. However, a systematic review noted that the evidence base remains in an embryonic phase, which means we're lacking high-quality, large-scale studies confirming a real performance benefit.
And here is the really counterintuitive finding that challenges the whole value proposition of these expensive boots.
Yes. An ACE-funded study directly compared them to active recovery. It found that simple, low-cost active recovery, like a very light cycling cooldown, actually cleared lactate more effectively than Normatec from the 15-minute measurement point onward.
That's the whole ROI discussion right there. Why invest hundreds or thousands in a device that is outperformed by a low-intensity workout you can do for free?
The body's natural muscle pump, the contraction and relaxation of muscles, is just superior to the passive external pressure of the boots for clearing lactate.
Which brings us back to the biggest biological paradox we mentioned at the top, the adaptation interference hypothesis. Why does reducing soreness sometimes hurt your long-term goals?
Okay, so the body requires a signal of stress to know it needs to grow stronger. Exercise-induced inflammation. That is the signal.
And that inflammation is mediated by molecules called reactive oxygen species, or ROS.
Right. Think of ROS as the cellular exhaust created when your muscle cells are working hard.
Cellular exhaust. I like that analogy.
When your body senses this exhaust, it activates these redox-sensitive signaling pathways. Mm-hmm. And these pathways are necessary for training adaptations, including things like mitochondrial biogenesis.
The creation of new cellular power plants in the muscle.
Exactly. So if you use an aggressive intervention to suppress that signal, to immediately eliminate the cellular exhaust,
I impair the adaptation. I'm basically telling my body the workout wasn't that hard, so it doesn't need to build bigger engines.
You've got it. And the evidence for this is robust. High-dose antioxidant supplementation, like vitamin C and E, was shown to blunt both strength and hypertrophy adaptations in trained men by preventing those necessary increases in mitochondrial biogenesis markers.
You can't cheat biology.
You can't. And the classic example of this trade-off in the device world is cold water immersion, or CWI.
So CWI is highly effective when used acutely, right? It reduces soreness, what we call delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS.
Hugely effective. The meta-analysis showed a standardized mean difference of METIGO 0.89 for soreness. That's a very large effect. It also improved power by a small to medium amount at 24 hours.
So it definitely makes you feel better and temporarily improves your readiness.
Yes. However, there is a massive caveat when it's used chronically after strength training.
Okay, here's the paradox.
Studies show chronic CWI used immediately after strength sessions blunted type 2 muscle fiber hypertrophy. And to put this into perspective for the strength athlete, control groups that avoided CWI saw a 135% improvement in muscle fiber growth over the training period.
And the CWI group?
Just 44%.
Oh, wait, 135% versus 44%. You are potentially sacrificing more than half of your muscle gains just to feel less sore after lifting.
That is precisely the choice you are making. Acute soreness relief over massive, long-term muscle gain. It proves that recovery interventions have to be periodized.
Okay, so if the expensive devices and anti-inflammatory methods carry these risks, where should the intelligent athlete start? We need to go to the undisputed tier one champion of recovery.
And that is sleep optimization. Sleep extension is the single most effective recovery intervention. It provides an estimated 80% of total recovery benefits. If you aren't prioritizing sleep, no gadget is going to save you.
It's the master intervention. What's happening physiologically during sleep that makes it so critical?
During deep non-rapid eye movement sleep, or NREM, your body releases growth hormone, which is essential for repairing damaged tissue. It's also when the brain flushes metabolic waste.
And we know sleep deprivation hurts performance.
A 2024 meta-analysis confirmed it, a significant impairment with an overall negative effect size of agonist 0.56.
But the timing of that sleep loss is critical, isn't it? When is the most damaging time to lose sleep?
The key detail is that the largest negative impact, a staggering minus 1.17 effect size, a huge drop in function, was caused by partial sleep deprivation at the end of the night.
So when you set your alarm clock a little too early.
Exactly. You're cutting off those final crucial cycles of REM and NREM sleep. So if you're habitually getting 7 hours, extending that by setting the alarm an hour later is the highest ROI move you can make.
It's that simple.
It is. When you get adequate sleep, your body achieves about 40% faster muscle regeneration compared to when you're sleep deprived. This is the foundation.
Let's move to tier two, protein intake. For years, we heard about the narrow anabolic window, rushing to chug a shake the second you finish lifting. Has that myth finally been put to rest?
It's been largely debunked. A massive 2013 meta-analysis by Schoenfeld and colleagues, reviewing 49 studies, found that total daily protein intake targeting between 1.6 and 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight was the single strongest predictor of training adaptations.
So immediate post-workout timing is less important than total volume over the whole day.
Precisely. The window is much broader, more like a garage door. It's open for 4 to 6 hours, maybe more, allowing you to space your intake.
But there's a crucial distinction here for our target listener, the master's athlete, someone over 40.
This is vital. As we age, we develop something called anabolic resistance. Our muscle tissue becomes less sensitive to the signal from protein.
So you need a bigger dose to get the same effect.
Exactly. Research shows master's athletes over 40 require about 40% more protein per dose, roughly 35 grams, versus the 20 to 25 grams for younger athletes to get the same muscle protein synthesis rates.
So it's not just hitting a total daily number. It's about spacing those robust 35-gram doses every 3 to 4 hours.
Correct. Now, let's also settle the debate between isolated branched-chain amino acids, or BCAAs, and complete proteins, like whey.
What's the verdict?
The verdict is clear. Isolated BCAAs are inferior to complete proteins. Whey protein, which has the full spectrum of essential amino acids, produces about 50% greater muscle protein synthesis than BCAA supplementation, even with similar BCAA content.
Why is that? BCAAs are the key building blocks.
Because muscle protein synthesis requires all the essential amino acids, not just the three BCAAs. If you only take BCAAs, you can start the process, but synthesis will just stall out, limited by the availability of the others. You need the whole team.
Okay, tier three, strategic cooling. Given the massive price tags on commercial cold plunges, can we achieve the same benefits cheaply?
Absolutely. A DIY cold water immersion setup gives you the same physiological stimulus. It's about temperature and duration, not the branding.
We need the optimal protocol, though. Is colder always better? Is longer always better?
A 2025 network meta-analysis gave us great specifics. For maximizing neuromuscular recovery and improving biomarkers, the most effective protocol was medium duration, low temperature. So 10 to 15 minutes at 5 to 10 degrees Celsius.
And what about if your main goal is just reducing soreness?
For coordinates reduction specifically, slightly warmer water was best, 11 to 15 degrees Celsius for 10 to 15 minutes. So you can tailor your protocol to your goal. But remember the periodization rule. Avoid chronic use after strength training if muscle growth is your goal.
And finally, what about contrast water therapy alternating hot and cold?
The mechanism is designed to stimulate circulation by alternating vasodilation and vasoconstriction.
Like a pump.
Right. But the aggregated evidence found contrast water therapy to be less effective than isolated CWI for most recovery outcomes. Isolated cold seems to be superior.
Okay, let's pivot to supplements. Tart Cherry Concentrate, or TCJ, has gained a lot of traction as a natural anti-inflammatory. What's the latest?
A comprehensive 2025 meta-analysis confirmed its benefits for muscular function and specific inflammatory markers like IL-6 and IL-8. The performance gains were modest overall, but some responders saw 13% faster half-marathon times.
13% is not marginal, but what are the practical trade-offs?
The main issue is compliance, and potential sugar intake. The active components are anthocyanins. To get enough of them, the protocols often require very high volumes of juice.
So you could be taking in a lot of sugar, which is inflammatory itself.
Exactly. It's counterproductive. So you need to seek out highly concentrated low-sugar forms or maybe capsules. And while we see stacking protocols emerging, like tart cherry plus omega-3s, the human testing on those combinations is severely lacking.
We need to wait for the data. What about curcumin from turmeric?
Curcumin shows measurable and reliable benefits. A 2024 meta-analysis found significant reductions in creatine kinase and muscle soreness.
And the critical nuance here is timing, just like with the devices, right?
Timing and dosage were absolutely critical. The research found that pre-exercise low-dose regimens were best for soreness. But immediate post-exercise high-dose supplementation was what optimally reduced the key damage biomarkers like CK and IL-6.
So you need a precision strategy, matching the timing to the specific effect you want.
You do. Now let's talk about optimizing the body's machinery by addressing micronutrient deficiencies.
Our strategy here is test before you supplement.
A perfect example is vitamin D. Data shows 36% to 57% of Americans are deficient. Repleting that, taking 2,000 to 4,000 IUs daily, leads to moderate to large effect sizes on power and speed.
But only in deficient populations.
Only in deficient populations. If your levels are fine, more vitamin D provides minimal, if any, benefit.
So spend $50 on a blood test before you spend money on supplements you might not need. What about magnesium?
Crucial. It's involved in over 300 enzymatic reactions. Athletes should consume 10 to 20% more than sedentary individuals, and studies suggest taking it about 2 hours before training to ensure proper energy utilization during the effort.
Let's address the marketing hype around one last supplement. Bromelain, the enzyme from pineapple.
We have to address this directly. While bromelain is heavily marketed for muscle recovery, we have to state clearly, bromelain lacks robust evidence in peer-reviewed sports medicine literature for athletic recovery. The recommendations far exceed the evidence quality.
So stick with the proven ones.
Exactly. Vitamin D, magnesium.
Finally, let's talk carbohydrate precision timing. Glycogen is the fuel, and restoring it quickly is paramount, especially in a multi-day tournament or something.
Glycogen recovery is a biphasic process. It's rapid in the first 30 to 60 minutes post-exercise because the muscle cells are super sensitive to insulin then. It slows down significantly after that.
So we have a short window of opportunity where the body is primed to refuel. What's the precision protocol to maximize that?
For short-term recovery, meaning less than 12 hours between efforts, the protocol is very precise. Aim for 1.2 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram of body weight each hour for the first 4 hours post-exercise.
And ideally, in what form?
Ideally, with a 4-to-1 carbohydrate to protein ratio. Simple, easily digestible carbs are best in this window to maximize uptake and minimize digestive distress.
Okay, so we've established that expensive devices are often outperformed by simple methods, and suppressing inflammation can be counterproductive. This all leads to the foundational strategy: recovery periodization. You can't use the same approach year-round.
Exactly. The periodization principle demands you match your recovery strategy to your training goal. Using an aggressive recovery protocol when you should be letting your body adapt is a massive strategic mistake.
Let's define the two extremes. First, the competition phase.
In the competition phase, your goal is immediate performance readiness, not long-term adaptation. Here, it is absolutely appropriate to use aggressive recovery, CWI, compression, anti-inflammatory supplements, selectively to maximize readiness for the next event.
And conversely, the training phase, when you're building capacity.
The goal here is maximizing adaptation. So you must allow controlled inflammation to signal that growth. This means you actively avoid chronic CWI or high-dose antioxidants right after strength training to prevent blunting that crucial type 2 muscle fiber hypertrophy.
That 135%, 44% difference we talked about.
That's the one. And this also demands sport-specific awareness.
Right, you can't treat a soccer player the same as a marathon runner.
Precisely. For intermittent sports, like soccer, the fatigue is complex muscle damage, glycogen depletion, mental fatigue. The priority is immediate glycogen and protein. CWI is appropriate between matches. And crucially, avoid static stretching post-match, as it can impair subsequent neuromuscular performance.
And for endurance sports like cycling or running.
Glycogen depletion and central fatigue are the big players, so immediate carb timing is priority one. Then, on rest days, the most effective tool is an active recovery ride or run at less than 50% of your threshold. It's a superior pump for clearing metabolic byproducts.
Finally, strength and power sports.
Here you have to focus on neural recovery, which is often overlooked. Heavy resistance training can reduce voluntary muscle activation for up to 72 hours. So the priority is protein spacing and strictly respecting that 72-hour recovery period between heavy sessions.
This brings us to a huge factor that undercuts all published research: individual response variability.
The biological variability is substantial, which is why a one-size-fits-all approach is doomed. A machine learning analysis of 120 marathon runners found that nearly 18% appeared to be non-responders to the interventions tested.
And why is that? Is it just genetics?
Genetics play a large role. A specific polymorphism, the ACTN3R577X polymorphism, affects type 2 muscle fibers. Individuals with the XX genotype show 2.5 to 4.7 times higher muscle damage markers after eccentric exercise.
So if you have that genotype, you just naturally need a longer recovery protocol.
Exactly. Regardless of what the average study participant requires. So the ultimate practical strategy is personalized tracking.
Move beyond the group average.
Absolutely. You have to track your personal response using things like heart rate variability or HRV and subjective readiness scores, rather than just assuming a study average applies to you.
Okay, we've covered a ton of ground. Let's synthesize this into a clear, actionable blueprint for the master's athlete, the person over 40 who has to confront these age-specific recovery constraints.
Right. Let's consolidate those non-negotiable demands. First, you face anabolic resistance, so you need that 40% more protein per dose, the 35-gram target.
Second, you need at least 72-plus hours for full recovery between heavy sessions to respect that neural lag.
And third, your soft tissue is more vulnerable. So the preliminary benefits of supplements like collagen with vitamin C become more relevant for tendon support. Recovery capacity drops by about 30% by age 50.
So let's construct the definitive cost-effectiveness hierarchy, the sequence of interventions to maximize ROI.
Okay, top ROI tier, highest priority, near zero cost. These are the free fundamentals.
Number one has to be sleep.
Sleep optimization, 7 to 9 hours nightly, prioritizing that last hour. Second, protein density and spacing, hitting those 35-gram doses across the day. And third, DIY CWI, but used only strategically during competition, avoiding chronic use after adaptation-focused sessions.
Okay, moving to the moderate ROI tier, a small targeted investment for measurable benefits.
This is your moderate ROI tier. First, basic compression garments. The inexpensive sleeves or socks, $30 to $60, achieve most of the benefits of the expensive pneumatic systems for a recreational athlete.
And they don't interfere with adaptation.
Exactly. And second, targeted supplements. Test first. Vitamin D if deficient. Tart cherry around hard efforts. Adequate magnesium. And consider collagen plus vitamin C for connective tissue.
And finally, the heavily marketed devices that offer the lowest ROI for the average athlete.
This is your low ROI last priority tier. It includes the expensive pneumatic compression systems and percussion massage guns. The consensus, including from institutions like the Cleveland Clinic, is clear. These devices have not been proven to improve speed, power, or endurance for recreational athletes.
They offer a perceived benefit, comfort, but not a physiological advantage over simple stretching or active recovery.
That's the bottom line.
Before we wrap, let's quickly circle back to the mind-body connection. Does mindfulness or meditation actually accelerate physical recovery?
They definitely help the mental side, which is huge. Mindfulness significantly reduced mental fatigue. A large effect size was noted in a study of elite athletes.
But for physical recovery?
The same study showed no significant differences for physical fatigue or muscle recovery markers. Breathing techniques promote the rest and digest state, but they lack strong evidence for directly accelerating muscle repair.
So if you feel mentally drained, mindfulness is a high ROI intervention. If you're trying to heal a muscle, stick to protein, carbs, and sleep.
Precisely. Prioritize the molecular and structural foundations first.
So what does this all mean for your training plan this week? Let's distill the three non-negotiable key takeaways from this deep dive.
Number one, the free fundamentals, sleep, protein, carbs, provide the highest ROI. It must be optimized before you even think about expensive technology. No device can compensate for bad fundamentals.
Number two, recovery has to be periodized. Chronic use of aggressive interventions like CWI or high-dose antioxidants during training phases can actively impair muscle growth. Use them selectively.
And number three, critical thinking is non-negotiable. Always check the funding sources for research. Prioritize systematic reviews over single studies. And recognize that commercial success does not guarantee physiological superiority.
So here's a final provocative thought for you to chew on. If your expensive recovery device makes you feel 100% better, but the gold standard clinical trials show zero improvement in your actual speed, power, or endurance, is your money buying you adaptation, or just a very well-marketed placebo? The ultimate ROI comes from mastering the basics first.
Find full research and sources at research.uda.me. That's Y-U-D-A dot M-E.